You got two floor mics. That's the easiest place to start from.
Yeah, there's someone on the sound. I'm just trying to find where he is.
Where's the guy? Where's the mic?
Probably not.
Yeah,
he's backstage. He's going to use the lavalier.
Oh, I gotta walk for a while instead of run. Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you all very much. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Think he's running for mayor of Minneapolis?
Of the what association?
Iranian.
Oh, yes, sir. How do you do? Hello there. Hello there. How do you do? Pleased to see you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, sir. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.
He could have, but he didn't
Thank
want
you,
to
sir.
Endanger his career.
Thank you. I do, sir. Yeah, all set? Let's go. Yeah. You go right ahead.
Why don't we start with the mic on that side of the room? Who's ever standing at the mic? I can't see it. Why don't you ask your question? And if you could all try to sit down, we can start.
I'm not going to get specific. I don't think anything.
Would you please speak up?
I won't get specific. Nothing here has been specific till now. But I'm going to ask something I think that is basic. The thing that stood out, you said people are going around saying, you're beautiful when you know they're really not. Well, that's not what it's all about. People aren't beautiful in the way they look. And if you don't understand that, you're not going to start solving any of these problems.
Do we have a question, possibly at this other mic?
In the light of your previous remarks on the necessity to take care and treatment of people, do you seriously, yes or no, believe that there will ever be a Nuremberg trial about the atrocities in Vietnam, and will you be called to answer for your actions there?
I couldn't say whether there would ever be anything like that. If I were to be called, I would surely be more than happy to state what my participation was. I happen to think that we might be a little bit better off to try to kind of look ahead, learn some lessons out of the experiences that we've had, which have been sad and costly experiences, and see if we can't do a little bit better than we did yesterday. I don't have 100 years yet to live. I intend to live every one of them for tomorrow. I don't intend to try to go back and even relive the election, much as I'd like to.
Why don't we just alternate? Is there one on this side of the room?
Yeah. You asked the dissenting Democrats to stay, so I hope this isn't a low blow. But all in all, knowing what you know now, if you could look back for a minute and speak honestly from your heart, do you feel that the war was worth it?
I don't believe anyone could have foreseen at the time of our involvement, which did not start in 1965, but started much sooner, what this war would really come to and what cost it would really entail or take from the American people. I happen to feel that the cost has been very high, and I hope and pray that we can find a prompt and quick answer to it, not only at the negotiating table, but in the de-escalation of this war in Vietnam. The things that have happened, such as the bombing pause, I actively supported. The development of a political infrastructure, which I thought was essential if you were going to have anything that was good out of it, I actively supported. I only think that history can give you the honest, objective answer to your question. I'm too deeply involved to do anything else but to be somewhat subjective. I did what I thought was right. I have not lived a life of private or public hypocrisy. I have made my mistakes. But they have not been mistakes, may I say, of the heart. They may at times have been mistakes of miscalculation. But public integrity to me is as important as intellectual integrity, and I've tried to have it to the best of my ability.
Professor Humphrey, you talked about people getting their facts straight before they ask questions, so first I'm going to get the facts straight, and then I'll ask the question.
Just one.
Yeah. Okay. The question regards the pace of desegregation of the public school system in Mississippi under the Democratic administration during its years in power. The latest statistics that I have seen, which are as of about 15 months ago by the Federal Commission on Civil Rights, state that 47% of the Mississippi public school districts are in compliance with the Supreme Court order on desegregation. They also state in the commission's pamphlet on racial isolation in public schools that precisely 2.5% of all black elementary and secondary school students in Mississippi attend schools where there is even one white person. Okay, now, these figures are as of approximately the 1st of January, 1967. By that time, the Democratic administrations had been in power for roughly 6 years. And the pace set up at this rate would be that from 1954 to that date, the pace would mean it will take 5 centuries to get the public school system desegregated. If all the change occurred only under the Democrats and not under the Republicans, it would take a mere 2.5 centuries. My question is that in power, did men like Robert Francis Kennedy not push hard enough, or is this the pace which we must stick to?
Well, if you want to know whether I think the pace is fast enough, the answer is no. That's for sure. As a matter of fact, I spent a good deal of my life in Congress trying to expedite many things. It took 16 years, for example, to get a Medicare program. I didn't think the pace was nearly good enough. I introduced the civil rights legislation as the first senator in 1949. We passed it in 1964. I don't think the pace was nearly good enough. We had 83 days of debate. I thought we ought to have been able to do it in 3. I didn't think the pace was nearly fast enough. But I'll tell you what, we made some progress. And we made the breakthroughs. And it has a way of moving in geometrical proportions, like compound interest. And we are beginning to make progress. And the important thing is to keep on the pressure. And to keep on the pressure, Democrats or Republicans in Congress, in the executive branch. I think we've got a lot of things to apologize for not having done well enough. But we lived within the political milieu of what was possible. I lost every southern state in this last election because I said that I would not slow down the pace, that I would indeed step up the pace. I paid a high price for it. And the man who is now President of the United States said during that time that the pace needed to be slowed down. I'm happy to tell you that since he became President, he hasn't slowed down the pace. More power to him. But that goes back to the other question. Political integrity. I was asked from the platforms in Jacksonville, Florida, in Charlotte, North Carolina, in Louisville, in Atlanta, and in many other places, Mr. Vice President, are you for the Department of HEW's guidelines? Do you think we're going too fast? Do you think we're going too slow? I said we're not going fast enough and they need to be enforced. Well, I didn't carry any of the southern states, but it was politically honorable, even if I suffered an ignominious defeat. But I think I've answered your question to the best of my ability.
Mr. Humphrey. Mr. Humphrey, would you comment on the Walker report of what happened in Chicago?
I think it's the best report and the most objective analysis that's been written on that tragic situation, and I hope it'll be studied for more than its headlines.
Mr. Humphrey, something you said during last summer in Chicago has been bothering me for a long time. While you were in your hotel room, the Los Angeles Times quoted you as saying, at the time of the demonstrations, that those people downstairs who were demonstrating didn't represent the majority feeling in the United States. And in effect, what I think that did was it practically condoned what the police were doing at the time. And I'd like you to explain this.
Well, I don't condone brutality on the part of anybody. I do not condone violence. I don't recall having said that, but if I didn't, I maybe should have. Because I don't happen to think that what was going on in terms of the violence and in terms of the protest represented the majority opinion of the United States. I don't think that's the case. I don't say that I want it quite clear. I think there were literally hundreds and thousands of people that were there that were deeply distressed with what was going on in the Democratic Party. that had honest feelings of conviction and felt strongly about the war and strongly in opposition to the administration's policy, and they had every right to do so and every right to be there. But let me make it very clear to you, sir, that there was a hardcore group that were determined that they were going to have some trouble, and they generally get it. And I want to, well, that, it's entirely possible that there may have been two hardcore groups.
Mr. Humphrey, I've been curious to know what happened to the MDTA program under President Johnson. The MDTA program. And what do you think about
program?
His Manpower Development and Training Act.
Oh, yes, MDTA. Pardon me. All right. Yes, sir.
What do you think its future potential is?
Well, I think it's done well. I think it's all a matter of funding, whether the resources are put to it. It has been very beneficial. It's helped train and retrain over 1 million workers, and I believe that's been a very constructive constructive achievement, and I hope that it'll be expanded. That's the Manpower Development and Training Act, which has been a great deal of help, particularly for persons that have been moved from one skill to another or persons that had no skills. Yes, sir.
You spoke today about the shortage of funds and the need for more projects to end poverty in America. And I'm sure we all share with you the need for these changes to be done soon. But I think you failed to mention perhaps what I think is the main reason why we cannot carry on these programs. As long as the United States is spending $70 billion a year, almost 10% of its gross national product on war, as long as we have our armies all over the world, and we are dedicated to this sort of holy crusade of fighting communism, I think perhaps we cannot carry on these projects, and this is the main reason. I'd like to ask you perhaps something which you can do now, as you're no longer a vice president, to contradict the president. Do you think we can have guns and butter? Can we carry on these wars? Can we carry on this crusade of anti-communism, of war, this constant thing which has been going on for the last 20 years, and still have butter and build up America and make it a much better place? Can we have both?
Well, you have described a situation as you wanted it. Let me try to answer it as I would like to. First of all, I'm not going to let you or anybody else off the hook too easy about what we can afford in this country, because we can afford a good deal more than we're doing. I don't happen to be very much of a person for guns. I've been spending a lot of my time in the field of disarmament. I'm trying right now to get university audiences and others interested in the anti-ballistic missile program so that this thing isn't launched to envelop us once again in a very costly defense expenditure. I said as a candidate for the office of president that if I were elected, I would immediately take an inventory of our commitments around this world and find which ones had priority and meaning in terms of contemporary conditions and which ones should be abandoned. In other words, to tidy up the house, to try to remove some of the extravagant costs that we obviously have, and as I indicated a moment here ago, not to try to be the master of the world, but rather to be a partner in this world. I happen to think that can be done. I must say that many a person today I've heard in and out of Congress say, well, we can't afford, Mr. Humphrey, to do anything about daycare centers. We can't afford community health centers, Mr. Humphrey, because 10% of our budget goes for defense. Well, I wish 10% didn't go, but let me tell you, that's one of the lowest defense budgets of any of the major nations. And we've got 90% left over. I mean 10% of our economy, GNP. We still have 90% left over. I'd like to see that percentage sharply reduced, but I want to make sure in the meantime that we don't give some people an easy out who, when you reduce that budget, still are not for daycare centers and still are not for educational programs and still are unwilling to do something about the cities. Let me give you a little experience. It's some advantage in the experience. I served in the Congress after the Korean War and during the Korean War. And I heard all the arguments. And they said, well, once we get this war over that was taking 14% of the GNP, and then 16% of the GNP, Once that we get that over, then we will be doing these wonderful things. Well, what happened when the war was over? I'll tell you what happened. Some of the folks that were voters went to sleep. The Congress didn't act. There was a new administration. Taxes were sharply reduced, and there wasn't a single anti-poverty program. There was nothing done in terms of federal aid to education. There was no launching of an attack upon the problems of pollution. There were no student scholarship loans. There was no public housing of any consequence. They just relaxed. Now, I'm not about ready to let somebody sell me that bill of goods again. I prefer not to have 10% of this budget for military purposes. I prefer it much less. But I want to tell you something. If we're going to indulge in that kind of thing called militarism on the one hand, the military budget, then I want you to indulge in a little bit of this civilian activity on the other hand. And how do we pay for it? And we can. Tax reform. There hasn't been a tax reform measure introduced for years. And all administrations, Republican and Democrat alike, are guilty. Now, I can speak with some integrity on this because I fought the battle of tax reform and found out that there were only 26 votes in the United States Senate. I had as my partner, one of the most brilliant economists in America at that time, Senator Paul Douglas. And we had major tax legislation before the Congress at the time of the Korean War. And instead of plugging loopholes, they opened some new ones. The middle income group in this country today is in a taxpayer's revolt. There are loopholes big enough in our tax laws to drive a semi-truck through. And that's where you're going to get some of this money. And may I say that instead of just trying to see how we're going to federate the whole world, which if we can get around to that, we'll work on it, would you concentrate your attention on tax reform for a while? And maybe we can build amongst young Americans that are voters, so that will be voters or are voters, a kind of consciousness so that when a man runs for Congress, the next time you'll say, Mr. Congressman, how do you stand on this tax bill and that tax bill and this issue and that issue? Instead of always saying, now, how do you stand on weapons, napalm, and so on, all of which is important, all of which you ought to ask him. But give him a little of the double treatment, would you? Both international and domestic, because if you don't, mark my words, there's enough movement in this country to keep the military budget big. I've been in Washington 20 years, and I know. The question is there enough social force in this country and ferment and enough activist political action in this country to keep the civilian programs moving? Is there enough to put concentration where it ought to be? And you're going to determine that. But you're not going to determine it unless you start talking about it, unless you understand what you're talking about. Tax reform. The dedication of funds for critical programs. That's one of the ways we'll do what we're talking about here today.
Mr. Humphrey, time for about one more question, and it's from this side.
I'd like to ask you a question, but you'll have to clarify a point for me first.
Yes, sir.
You seem to be saying hooray for people and very happy about people, and yet you criticize Robert Taft and the legislature for giving into public opinion vis-a-vis the housing. Now, what do you really mean by the public opinion that they're considering?
Well, I wasn't trying to criticize Robert Taft. I was trying to pat him on the back. I'm very grateful for his leadership of the Housing Act.
Well, you mentioned the legislature.
What I was saying is, sir, that legislators generally vote what is the prevailing popular will, public opinion. But the purpose of an education and the purpose of political action is to change public opinion.
Well,
if
now,
you
what
feel
do you mean
strongly
by public
about
opinion?
It.
Are you talking about special interest groups, pressure groups? You mentioned the Port Authority. I'll mention the National Rifle Association and the John Birch Society for two more.
Yes, I don't
and
like either one of those last two.
There's a great problem in this country that... And there seems to be a great problem in this country that most of the force brought upon the legislators in the Capitol comes from special interest groups. Now, how do you suppose that we can subvert this and get around it? What are we going to do?
Well, may I say, first of all, you're right. Most of the pressure that's brought to bear upon many of the legislators is from a group that has a particular special interest. Now, not all special interests are, in my book, bad. For example, to save the redwoods, that was a special interest group, and I was interested in it. I thought it was a good idea that we ought to save them. There's a special interest group in this country that happens to feel that we ought to do a great deal more about conservation and the dedication of public lands for the purposes of national parks. I'm for that. I think you have to make your choice as to what kind of a society you want. Now, there's going to be a very strong group, for example, in America, that's going to try to convince you and convince me that you're going to get more defense, that you're going to feel more secure out of an anti-ballistic missile program. I just don't think you are, and I'm going to go around this country and argue the other way, and I know a little something about it. Now, that's two special interests, but I like mine better. And I think that's the way that you have to have conflicting interests. And when you come to tax laws, and this is very dangerous to say out here in California, but there are such things as we call depletion allowances. Are they too much or are they too little? Is the capital gain structure in the tax law equitable? Are some of these loopholes that permit, that really aggravate mergers, that permit companies that have made large amounts of money to go in and buy a company that's lost money and thereby to absorb the losses in order to pay less taxes, thereby increasing the rate of merger at the same time that the Justice Department is prosecuting them for merger? Does that make much sense? I think not. Now, I'd like to do something about that. And how are we going to do it? Like meetings like this. Not in a moment. We're going to have to study it. We're going to have to look into it. And I want some of the enthusiasm that the student bodies of American colleges have directed towards these constructive things. Do you think it'd be better in America if there were community health centers for the poor people of this country and for others? Do you think it'd be better in America if working mothers could have daycare centers where they could put their children and not to leave them on the streets of the ghetto? Do you think it'd be better in America if we did have a program where people could both own or rent a decent home regardless of income? I think so. Do you think it'd be better in America to have a form of income maintenance that did not denigrate and downgrade and humiliate the poor people of this country? I think so. Is a negative income tax good or bad? Is a form of income maintenance good or bad? We ought to study it. And this is where young Americans are going to come into their own in terms of political maturity. Somebody said, should we have the 18-year-old vote? I think so. I've advocated it for years. But I want to be sure that 18-year-olds know that what they're voting about. And I want to be sure that they know that they're voting on crucial issues, not just the issues of peace and war, which are frequently dramatized in very, very bold terms, but the nitty-gritty of what an appropriation bill is about. You can have all the dreams in the world about model cities, but if you can't get any money, you're not going to get any model cities. And when I stop to think of what happened in the Congress of the United States, when I know that there were 14,000 cases of infectious, dangerous rat bite reported to public hospitals in 1967, and one congressman got up and laughed the whole bill out of Congress when we tried to appropriate a few million dollars to help cities clean out rodents. Now, if you want something that you can do now, well, I'll tell you, you can kill rats, and we know how to do it. And we got the money to do it, and we have the program to do it. Simple things, may I say. These are things that I think students can get activated on, as well as Vietnam and Biafra. And by the way, I hope that you'll do a lot about that. I think the Biafran Relief Program is vital. But may I suggest that there's some hungry people in California? We can feed both. We've got enough to do both, and I'm not going to let the young man off the hook. A country that can build racetracks, saloons, country clubs, and by the way, I've been to all of them. A country that can do that can also build hospitals and daycare centers and schools and kindergartens and preschool programs. We have what it takes to do it. And all you have to do is take a look at the waste in this country, and you know that with more commitment and with better priorities, we'd get it done. And that's not fancy talk. It's hard, plain talk. I suggest that we start to get at the things that we can do something about. And then we'll build ourselves up to do something about the bigger things. I guess that's enough.
Thank you very much. Thank you.